I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. I said happy Thanksgiving today to the conductor on my train, to the cop at the top of the stairs at the SEPTA station, and to a man in a wheelchair at the corner of 8th and Ray Streets. It's been such a traumatic, isolating, frustrating, and depressing year and a half. It feels good to feel grateful in anticipation of Thanksgiving and to share it with others. We've invited three cooks to be our guests on the show today to talk about food and family and friends and community and culture. Let me introduce the two guests who are here with us in our Philadelphia studio. Kiki Araneta is a chef, food writer, and former owner of the Hawaii-centric Poi Dog restaurant in Philadelphia, which she had to shut down due to the pandemic. She has her own sauce company, Poi Dog Sauces. And Kiki Araneta, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Also with us is chef and activist Kurt Evans, who mixes cooking with a mission to reduce recidivism by helping formerly incarcerated people find work in the hospitality industry. He got the Champion of Change Award earlier this year. And Kurt Evans, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us from her home is Reem Kassis, author of the Arabesque Table Cookbook. She'll share some of her Palestinian family recipes and discuss the important role that food plays in preserving history and culture. And Reem Kassis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, and happy Thanksgiving to all three of you. I do want to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving, but each of you has such an interesting story to tell about your relationship to food and the food business, whether it's cookbooks or restaurants. And I'll start with you, Kiki. What are you doing for Thanksgiving tomorrow?
Tomorrow I'm headed to Brooklyn. This is my second Thanksgiving away from my family in Hawaii. At least as far back as I can remember. And we're going to be getting together with our Brooklyn family, as I like to call them. Jen, who was my bridesmaid at my wedding last week. And a bunch of other people who are in the wedding party and part of our celebrations leading up to it. So we're also bringing my new husband, Ari's mother, Phyllis. It's my first time celebrating Thanksgiving with her, and John Winterman, Jen's husband, is in charge of all the festivities, and I believe there's a champagne fountain and lots of other fun things.
Wow. And what, are you going to make something specifically from your Hawaii culture?
I will not be making anything from my Hawaii culture. However, we will be contributing a salmon mousse in the shape of Hello Kitty, which has become, it will be the second year. So I feel like it will become a new Thanksgiving tradition.
Indeed. I would like to appropriate that. To you, Kurt Evans, what are you doing tomorrow?
Tomorrow I will be with my co-founders of Everybody Eats. We are going to the city of Camden. We are doing a give back tomorrow. We are feeding people in the city of Camden. And after that, we take food to halfway homes, reentry houses in the city of Philadelphia.
Is that a kind of traditional turkey and all the trimmings?
We started that doing that last year. So.
And how many people do you anticipate? Do you know?
Last year we did about 600. We're looking to do about the same amount.
600 people.
Yes.
Wow. And where are you cooking? Where are you going to do the cooking?
We have Everybody's. We just signed our lease for a food hall in Chester. So we're also hiring and providing food for people in Chester as well. So we're doing a lot of our prep out of our food hall in Chester.
In Chester. To you, Reem Kassis, I was reading that I think this is your first Thanksgiving that you're going to cook. Do I have that right?
You do, yes.
And so what's on the menu?
So obviously there's the requisite turkey because I'm hosting my first ever Thanksgiving for my husband's family. But I naturally am also doing something that reminds me of my Palestinian family back home. So I'm roasting a whole leg of lamb, and that's going to be surrounded by fricke and pine nuts, which is a version of the stuffing that we use traditionally back home.
And spices? Are you using spices that have some Palestinian roots to them?
So I don't know that they're Palestinian from where they hail, but they're definitely used in our cooking, and somehow they seem to cross over with Thanksgiving. So there's a lot of nutmeg, a lot of cinnamon, allspice, cloves, cardamom as well, which might not be very common, but it seems that this particular season has a lot of crossover with Middle Eastern spices.
Interesting. Let me go back to you, Kurt, but also to you, Reem. I know as a young boy growing up in Philadelphia. Do I have that right?
Yes.
You grew up here. That your grandmother was perhaps the sort of center of cooking in your family?
Yeah. Both of my grandmothers, actually. They were pretty much the cooks. My grandmother, she cooked at her church. My grandmother had 10 kids, so she used to always say, I could never feed a small amount of people. I would burn food. So
The better, right?
Yeah. So it wasn't even like so much of Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was something that was just like, oh, another day. But my grandmother would cook all the time. Right. It just would be just constantly family over. And being Muslim, like my grandmother having offspring that her children became Muslim, and then like their offspring are Muslim now, is like just the way she got us together to congregate. It had been like, oh, probably the day before Thanksgiving, so it wouldn't be too touchy, like, you know. Or and then she, you know, changed a lot of her products from cooking with pork to a lot of turkey, smoked turkey and things like that, like when she's making her collard greens and stuff like that.
And were you the kid sort of at her side watching her?
Of course,
letting
yeah.
Her,
yeah. I think a sweet potato pie was like one of the first things I ever learned how to make as a cook. Like besides like butchering fish or turkey or chicken and stuff like that, but a sweet potato pie was like the first thing I learned how to make.
And how old were you?
Probably about 9.
About 9?
Yeah.
And it turned out okay?
Yeah, it turned out great. I mean it was always my grandmom was the queen of, I'm only going to tell you one time.
Oh, there you go. So pay attention,
so pay attention.
I know for you, Reem, grandmothers have played such an important role in the family and in food preparation. Can you speak to that?
Of course, yes. So both my grandmothers were actually well known in their respective circles for being good cooks. You know, my paternal grandmother was the one people called if there was a wedding to taste test the food for them. But unlike Kurt, I actually wasn't really around them in the kitchen while they were cooking. I was often shooed out because we were the generation that they expected to leave the kitchen, to not end up there. But I think a lot of what I did glean from those, you know, holidays and weekend gatherings, kids are like sponges. And I think once I started cooking on my own, I started to realize how much of it, what felt like innate, was actually things that over the years I had absorbed from eating their food and listening to their conversation, which often revolved around food. And it was the way they brought us all together, I guess.
Well, shoot out of the kitchen, but now you're back in the kitchen,
I know,
correct?
Right?
And we'll pick up on that. Let me turn to you, Kiki. Help us understand, I guess, your family and food.
So I'm half from Hong Kong and half from Hawaii. And I come from two families that are absolutely obsessed with food. Like on both sides, although they're very, very different, they're both the kind of people who sit down at a wonderful meal and they're already planning the next meal.
Really?
Neither of them are we don't have a lot of great cooks in our family, but we all have the concept of like one dish belongs to us. So for example, in Hawaii, like there is no Thanksgiving without poke, is something that I say.
I read that, yes. No, go ahead, explain.
And usually poke is up to me or my dad because we're in the minority of family members who don't live in Hawaii anymore. And so we're frequently tasked with going to places like Tanioka's to pick up the poke. In Hawaii, poke is a composed dish. It's not something that resembles a salad. You go to a place that's sort of like a deli, and you get a pound of taco poke, a pound of spicy ahi poke, and maybe 2 pounds of shoyu ahi poke, which is my favorite, and you bring it to the table. So there's an idea that like the person who makes the poke is the one who's in charge of seasoning it, and I have a lot to say about this, but in other words, there's no Thanksgiving without poke.
I hear you.
Yeah, and my contribution is to get the poke. But everybody else has a task in the family. Like my Auntie Diane, who's Okinawan, has taken it upon herself to represent the non-existent Armenian side of our family, which involves making a painfully rolled out sesame lavash and pairing it with a spinach and water chestnut dip. We are from Hawaii, so like the thing that binds us is mayonnaise.
I did not know that.
Yeah, we're obsessed with mayo in Hawaii. And everybody else has a different job. It's making the turkey, for example, or contributing the saimin, which are typically fried soy sauce-based noodles. And And these roles are pretty much broken down pretty clearly. Like, everybody knows what they're supposed to be doing. And if they don't know what they're supposed to be doing, they just bring something anyway.
Sounds like fun. Let me go back to you, Rima, and actually to all three of you. I mean, food memories are so powerful, I think, because it does involve our senses. I mean, if you smell something, it's so easy to be transported back to being, you know, that little kid and smelling something, Rima, that, you know, is coming from the kitchen.
It is. You're absolutely right. And that's actually part of the reason why there are dishes that to this day I don't like to cook at home, because they remind me so much of being with my family. You know, stuffed chicken, for example, is something that it was my favorite dish growing up. And it's what my mother makes when I go home to visit. It's what my grandmother used to make when I would come back from university. And even though it would be perfect to do that kind of dish for Thanksgiving, after all, it's a, you know, poultry, sure, and there's stuffing and whatnot, I still refrain from doing that, mostly because to me it's a very sentimental dish, and it evokes a lot of memories and feelings that I feel are only right to share when you're with the people who help build those memories for you. And I think it impacts also the way you experience food. You know, foods that are associated with certain experiences and people tend to have a different flavor on your palate, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Kurt, do you want to add to that? I'm thinking, I mean, they're all the senses involved, you know, the visual, the taste, the smell.
I mean, yeah, you know, Reem, she, like, kind of hit it on the head. Sometimes some things are, like, sentimental, you don't want to do, you know, other than, especially, like, sometimes when I do things, like, if I'm frying chicken, I'm going to fry chicken the way my grandmother taught me how to do it. So it's really sentimental in that process. So, yeah.
And how did she do it?
Oh, man, you guys want me to divulge secrets?
Well, you kind of tantalize me.
Well, I will give, like, so it was like it was like a labor of love. It was never was like a really a quick process. It was never like a quick process. So even like breading the chicken, sitting it on a rack and sitting in the refrigerator before you fry it to get the skin crispy on it was like, that's a process. So it was like things like that. It's not like, you know, hey, we just dip it in, like you see on the YouTube channel right now, right, on fried chicken, it'll be like batter, flour, then dip it, but, you know, little different tricks, and then things she put in her oil to season her oil as she fried chicken. So it's very, like I said, it's very like sentimental, like especially when that is passed down by like by word of mouth and like showing you how to do something, and then I'll show my kids how to do that as well. So yeah, that's very important.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Kurt Evans. He's a Philadelphia chef and activist. Reem Cassis joins us. She's written two cookbooks, The Arabesque Table and The Palestinian Table. And Kiki Araneta is a chef and food writer. And she's got her own sauce company, Poi Dog Sauces. And you can join our conversation. Any food memories, we do want to hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the fram sauce with the Orson Fee, with Shafafa on the side.
A little Nat King Cole there, Frim Fram Sauce, and we are talking about food today on Radio Times with Kiki Araneta, with Kurt Evans, and with Reem Cassis. You know, it's so interesting. The three of you all got into the sort of food business, whether restaurant or writing cookbooks, as you do, Reem, but none of you went to culinary school. And I think it's an interesting sort of journey. And I'll turn first to you, Kiki. You had a food truck for a number of years before opening your restaurant.
Yes, and that was my first real foray into food. I was in graduate school for a long time, and I taught for a very long time. I was in classics, so Latin and Greek, which is a little bit different. Although I did have some research interests in food, in the history of garum, for example, during the Roman Empire, and I got really burnt out. It was very difficult to be a graduate student in classics, especially for as many years as I was. And I worked in a lot of restaurants, and I loved the energy of them. I loved getting my hands into food whenever people would let me. And I was just, like, truly fascinated with the world. And it was at a time when food trucks were very, very popular. Remember the movie Chef?
I do. And yeah. I remember food trucks, sure.
So, like, there was, like, this food truck craze, and it just so happened at the restaurant that I was working at, one of the garde-manger cooks was selling his food truck.
Wow.
So my then partner, Chris, and I, we decided to buy it. We pretty much had the lowest cost food truck startup of all time, I believe.
How much are we talking?
We started an entire business. Like, we got the commissary, the food truck, the SUV, every single bit of cooking appliance, and branding for under $17,000.
Oh my goodness.
Which is what we had, so that worked out. And yeah, so we ran the food truck for 4.5 years before opening a restaurant, and when we opened the food truck, I thought I was the only person from Hawaii in Philadelphia, and very, very quickly, as I started serving spam musubi and mac salad and kalua pig, Hawaii people started coming out of the woodwork.
That's how food works, right?
Yeah. And people would come up, and I remember, like, the first time we, like, served food at, like, Head House Market, some people came up to me and they ordered. I didn't look at them. Like, I was head down trying to make the food. And somebody ordered, like, a spam musubi with a scoop of mac salad on the side. And I was like, you know, if I was a person in Philadelphia who is homesick and saw a food truck called Poi Dog, which means mixed breed or mutt in Hawaiian pidgin, and thought maybe there might be some sort of comfort food for me there, that's exactly what I would order. And the person who turned up to be ordering, I had gone to middle school with in Hawaii. So, yeah, and then, like, it's reconnected me with so many people that I hadn't even seen since I was 12 years old.
How about for you, Kurt? I mean, you've had, it seems, so many different kinds of chef cook jobs in the food biz.
Yeah, yeah. Started out as a cook. I mean, you know, that's like really what I did, like, from first conception of a job was a McDonald's. I was a line cook at McDonald's when I was in high school. And then my mother, she's worked for Aramark for a very long time, and she would open up an account. She was account manager, so she would open up an account and, like, hey, we're opening this account. And I would, like, just follow my mom.
Oh,
but
wow.
She would go for it. She would go set up all of the back end stuff, the front house stuff. And then, you know, she'd go to another account. And I knew a lot of the chefs on the team because when my mother was a kitchen manager back in 1995, 1994, I would come to the hospital on the weekends and work, you know, just not work because it was illegal, but I would be in the kitchen, you know, with the cooks and the chefs. So they had known me since I was like a kid.
Yeah.
So easily got those jobs. And then a friend of mine, Alan Young, he's actually down in Virginia now, doing Major Philly Cheesesteaks. He was my partner in a venture called Route 23. It was a restaurant on Germantown Hunting Park where we did takeout, you know, a straight dive spot where it was burgers, steaks, fries. We pretty much came up with this dish called a salmon cheesesteak. So
salmon cheesesteak.
Yeah, because we sold salmon entrees. And when we butchered the fish, we would have the body left. So we would make a salmon chowder out of the body, the head and everything. And it would be scraps left, like the belly fat and like the pieces from the ends. And, you know, we just was like, hey, you know, we don't want to throw this away. What could we do with it? And we just played around and we made a salmon cheesesteak. So it had red pepper, spinach, a spicy sriracha bechamel sauce that we put over top instead of just putting regular cheese. Yeah, we did that. And then from there, just went from staging at certain restaurants because I wanted to do fine dining. Like, you know, I was like, oh, man, I wanted to see if I could, you know, try my hand at it because, you know, I have a lot of cookbooks. So it was like, this is what I want to do. But I didn't know if I could keep up in the kitchens because I came from mass production cooking. Right. So, yeah, but then I made my way in the industry and worked at several places. Just recently co-founded a pizza shop, Down North Pizza. But as of a couple months ago, I've walked away, signed my ownership over to the employees, my equity. I had my stake in the business, and I've been Everybody Eats, a new project. I'm starting Project More.
Dealing with food insecurity.
Yes.
Speaking of cookbooks, Reem Kassis, I mean, you're a Wharton grad, and as you said, you were shooed from the kitchen as a kid growing up, and now you're back writing cookbooks.
You're right. You know, I worked in consulting after business school. I worked in executive search in London, and it was only when my first daughter was born that I was on maternity leave for a full year. And I think I started panicking, thinking I'm raising her away from my family and our culture and the things that helped shape who I was. And what started out as a little project of my collecting my family's recipes and stories evolved into the Palestinian table. Because I think when I saw those recipes and stories coming together, I thought, yes, these are the recipes and stories of my family, but taken together as a whole, they could be the story of any Palestinian family. And that, Marty, as you know, is a narrative that's not the one that was most often heard about my people. And, you know, initially I thought, okay, I'll write this cookbook. I'll do this as a mission, as my way to give back to my people. And it kind of took on a life of its own. And that's when I realized that being in the kitchen out of choice, not out of circumstance, makes it a very powerful place, right? I don't think my grandmothers could have ever envisioned someone having a platform out of a kitchen in which you're able to write about your culture and help to mainstream it and raise awareness about the issues that you face. And I think that's why I never ended up going back to the business world and have stayed in food and food writing.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so interesting how each of you came to what it is that you do. And speaking of recipes, and do you, Reem, think of them as kind of like a science experiment or an art project in terms of trying to put together something that you think other people that might not know your culture or even some of those tastes would want to try?
I think I look at recipes as a blueprint more than anything. You know, they're a guide to help you cook, but there's only so far that a recipe can take you. Because, and there's something in Arabic that we call nafas, and I've written about this before, it's the intangible thing that you bring to a dish that you cook. It's, you know, for some people, the seasoning might be different. For other people, your palate might be used to different flavors. So I'd like to tell people in my recipes, this is how it's supposed to taste, this is how it's supposed to look, and this is how you achieve that. But here are other ways in which you can adapt it to suit you. Because at the end of the day, my goal is to have people experience this food and enjoy it. And I think being very rigid with that doesn't serve that purpose. So I always tell them, take it as a blueprint.
Take it as a blueprint. And for you, Kiki, and I'm imagining in your food truck as sort of a way to experiment with different kinds of foods.
Yes, absolutely. And I for many years have wrestled with the notion of like, all right, certain things, certain ingredients have to come from Hawaii. Like you have to get this feathery purple seaweed called okonori, for example. And then as I grew into the notion that Philadelphia was my home now and wanting to cook more from the perspective of using the wonderful local things that I have available here, I had to make a lot of decisions on, for example, like the proteins that I serve. In Hawaii, we have tons and tons of different fresh fish.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Ahi is very, very plentiful. But in order to make more, for example, like sustainable poke options, I've turned towards other fish that are not flown from Hawaii and that are more easily accessible here. But then I turned to seaweeds and seasonings that evoke Hawaii and not necessarily have to be brought from there. I mean, I did have my dad bring a lot of things, and I constantly used to joke that If somebody asks, like, oh, where did you get this? Or where do you get your furikake? Or where do you get whatever? I'd be like, well, I had it sent via dad post.
Everyone needs a dad like that. And to you, Kurt, you have lots and lots of cookbooks, correct?
Yeah.
Do you know how many?
Over probably like 1,000.
Over 1,000. Yeah. You've been, what, just collecting over the years?
Yeah, it came out as just, you know, one in certain cookbooks. Then it's like, oh, it became, oh, it has to be a first edition. Because now it started being like older cookbooks. So it's like, I only want the, like, the earliest edition possible.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Are you on eBay looking for this stuff? Or
eBay, antique bookshops. There's a lot of different sites. And then you put stuff on like Google Alert. So if you're looking for books, they'll just like, oh, so yeah, it's a hobby. And then once you start purchasing from certain people, they're already like, hey, we have this book. It may be in your interest. So, yeah,
so like you that. Have them all in a bookshelf somewhere?
Bookshelf. Or? Some of them are in like, some of them have to be wrapped in plastic and like put up. So.
And do you read them?
Yes. For me, the cookbooks are about like stories and techniques and tradition and like a lot of cookbooks. They have like the older cookbooks. They actually, I had a joking with a chef friend like last week, and we were talking about how you read a new cookbook and it's like, you know, take some chicken stock and add some xanthan gum and you have sauce. But when we think about like older cookbooks, they really break down sauce making and, you know, traditional things and why you should do things. So yeah.
To you, Reem, and I'm curious about, in terms of understanding Palestinian, or as you say, Arabesque cooking or the Arabesque table, what are some of the kind of the bases that this cuisine is built on?
So it's interesting because the Arabesque table really diverged from the Palestinian table. You know, that one was very much traditional recipes, which, to your question, you know, they rely on things that are part of the landscape and the geography, you know, the legumes that we're used to growing and eating. And it's the society that was historically peasant. So meat wasn't plentiful. And we found lots of ways to make dishes extend and feed large groups of people and really be at one with the land and what it was providing you. And the Arabesque table, I think, I tried to capture what a modern way of eating looks like today for Arabs. And I think I realized along the way that to do that with integrity, you actually have to go back in history. And what I realized about our part of the world is that so many ingredients have their roots in Western Asia, which is the present day the Middle East. And so many of the spices that we use and so many of the techniques that we even learn about in French cuisine have their roots in medieval Arabic cookery. So to me, it was very fascinating to learn that, but it also makes it very difficult to say this is the one thing that is, you know, from this part of the world or this specific technique or spice. But I think if I had to pinpoint one thing to answer your question, I'd say it's a cuisine that's very comfortable with the landscape in which it has evolved. You know, it's very much in touch with, we eat goat or lamb. We don't eat a lot of beef. Our dairy comes from sheep. Our spices tend to be warm spices. And, you know, a lot of our greens are foraged and bitter, which are sweetened with onions that are grown locally. So it's very much a cuisine that's a function of the place in which it has developed.
Well, if there's one thing that we have learned from the pandemic is just when it came to restaurants and restaurant workers, that these were in many ways essential workers, people on the front line. And I know for you, Kiki, you had a restaurant, and it must be so painful to think about shutting it down, but the pandemic really forced your hand.
It did, and we were one of the first shutdowns due to the pandemic. And it was, like, I don't regret it, and I think we shut the restaurant down at a good time. And I think a lot of people might not understand why we did so early, but we were based in Center City, and our restaurant customers were primarily from law firms, Comcast, office buildings, and our biggest catering customer was actually UPenn, which of course wasn't in session for many months. So when we had to hand back our deposits, like, this was back in March 2020. Like, we knew immediately that this was going to be a very dire financial situation, and we didn't want to wait for it to become more dire. So And we also closed at a time that we were able to garner a lot of attention for the people who are working for us. And it's really incredible to see the businesses that have grown out of the people who worked at Poydog. So we used our last service as a way to first share our favorite poke with our loyal customers, and also to highlight the businesses of our employees, such as Jomar Jalal, Jambru. I believe that was the first time that he actually served his wonderful kombucha, at least on that scale. And Alejandro Gonzalez, who now makes wonderful tamales under the moniker Señor Slices, as well as Chance Anies, who owns the soon-to-be brick-and-mortar, also a food truck of also a Filipino food truck, Tabachoy, and he served lechon alongside our poke stalwart dishes.
Well, what I hear you saying is that, and we're almost up in a break here, is that food trucks may be coming back, but also the kind of idea of reinvention. I mean, cooking is all about creativity.
Yes, it's all about creativity and also sharing, and like, if anything, I think the legacy of Poydog, the restaurant, has created more open spaces for sharing and for cooking together and collaboration. And at least I hope that's a legacy. Well, so far, so good.
So far, so good. Well, that is Kiki Aranija, and talking about a restaurant that she had here in Philadelphia, a Poydog. And she also had a food truck, and now she's got sauces, her own sauce company. Kurt Evans is with us as well. He's a Philadelphia chef and an activist. We'll be talking about some of the work that he has been doing with incarcerated people. And Reem Cassis is the author of two cookbooks, Arabesque Table and The Palestinian Table. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Your food stories. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago, it was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving.
When, of course, Arlo Guthrie, Alice's Restaurant, a song that I believe is more than 50 years old. Well, we are talking about restaurants, we're talking about eating, cooking, food, culture, community. And again, you can always join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Kurt, I do want to talk with you about some of the work that you do with incarcerated people who have been released from prison. How did you get involved in that, using the, I guess, the food or restaurant industry is as a kind of an entree?
Yeah. So my first experience with food activism, it came through helping friends of mine, Christina Martinez and Ben Miller, on their Right to Work dinner series, highlighting undocumented workers' rights to work in kitchens.
And that was down at their restaurant in South Philly, right?
Yeah. And yeah. They did them on scales. I think the first couple was at their restaurant, but then it started moving into like venues where we were feeding like hundreds of people that came to show up. And from there, 2017, I started the EMI and Mass Incarceration Dinner Series, where we would bring people together, lawmakers, policy politicians, lawmakers, and community organizers, people together to come up with solutions about this pressing issue of mass incarceration. And even in 2016, when we had the restaurant Route 23, my business partner, Alan Young, he instilled this thing of, you know, one day we had about four PO officers, parole officers come check up on our employees. And I was like, wow, you know, we hire a lot of people that's been formerly incarcerated. I was like, you know, that's a good thing. And he's just like, it's not a good thing. He was like, if we won't, who else will?
Wow.
And it was just like a way of like taking care of people that, you know from your neighborhood. And so from the EMI dinners, it just propelled me into doing more work around mass incarceration. Today, my catering company, Compliment Your Lifestyle Hospitality Group, you know, we exclusively give first look chance to people that's been formerly incarcerated. We hire people, and my work with 215 People's Alliance has been around bringing awareness to the court system. We've been doing a lot of work with the judges, candidates, the district attorney. We do a lot of electoral work, and along with Project More is something that I started with the seed money that I won from the Champion of Change Award. It's a business accelerator for formerly incarcerated food entrepreneurs, and at the end of the 12-week program, they will be granted $3,500 to grow their business or expand the existing
idea. Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, this wonderful marriage of food and activism and making a difference.
Yeah.
And hiring people.
And the thing about food and activism in the Black community is something that's been going on for years. I mean, when you go back to Georgia Gilmore, the activism she did around selling platters to, like, really sustain the bus boycott movement. Sister Shez Waddles out in Detroit. She sold platters and also was able to get a community center, a health center, and a lot of things like that. So activism, even with the Black Panthers, food and activism in the Black community is something that's been going on for like years.
Well, I was even thinking of the civil rights, you know, boycotts of restaurants that, you know, refused to feed Black people, and lo and behold, activists would sit at the counter demanding to be fed.
Yes.
Let me turn back to you, Kiki, and in terms of understanding, I was reading about you, and you said in terms of hiring people, as Kurt was talking about, that you looked for kindness. And I circled that because I thought, what an interesting quality to look for someone to work in a restaurant.
Man, I haven't thought about being a business owner, like in charge of a lot of people, in a couple of years now. And we looked to kindness because we just, like, honestly, we just wanted nice people to work with.
It's very intense work.
Yeah. So in the very beginning, neither Chris nor I came from a culinary background. We had also not run a business before. Everything that we learned about running a business and like came from like figuring out how to do the numbers, learning about like profit and loss sheets. And this was all from the Wharton SBDC program, which unfortunately is no longer in existence, but it was a great boon to us to be a part of it. And so we went into the business like theoretically knowing how to operate a business. We went in knowing how to be good employees, but we didn't know how to be employers. So in the very beginning, when we interviewed people, we looked for things like knife skills and experience. And we found that sometimes personalities they could easily be upset by a strong, like strong aggressive personalities. So that's something that we didn't really want in our restaurant. Also, I'm from Hawaii. Like, we're really nice people. We want to get...
Why wouldn't you want kind people, right?
We're really nice people. And our business philosophy behind Poi Dog, it troubled me for many years that people would come in and ask, like, oh, so how did you come up with this concept? I'm like, it's not a concept. I'm from Hawaii. There's a food that we make. And in Hawaii, society is governed by this notion of aloha, which is not just hello, goodbye, love. It's respect for other people. And so we wanted aloha and respect to govern the little piece of Hawaii that we created here in Rittenhouse. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't have anybody in our doors who ignored this idea of respect and ignored the tenets of aloha. And so we looked more for people who would get along with others, who would go out of their way not to step on anybody's toes and to make other people's lives better for each other. And before long, we had a staff of people who all aligned themselves to this notion.
Let me turn to you, Reem. Have you ever worked in a restaurant?
I have not, no.
Did you ever want to do that?
No, to be perfectly honest with you, and I've been asked this question many times.
I'm
you know,
sure.
You have these cookbooks, why don't you open a restaurant? And I think writing about food and cooking food in a professional setting are two very different things. And quite frankly, you know, you have two restaurant owners on the line. They tell you it's very hard. I don't think I have what it takes to actually run a restaurant, because to me, cooking is about expressing love to the people that I am cooking for. It is about expressing myself. It is about preserving my heritage. And I feel sometimes when you start to do something professionally, there's a lot that goes into it other than that, right? You know, and as Kiki was telling you, there's the P&L side of it. There's the consistency side of it. There's the employment side of it. And you start to lose the part, for me, that I am trying to work towards, which is more about using my skill set of writing and sharing the information about my people and their history with others around the world. And I found that my strength was in writing much more so than in, you know, running an actual restaurant.
And to you, Kurt, you've run and worked at a lot of restaurants. Take us inside the kitchen, the line. I mean, what that is like for people that have never worked in a restaurant.
Yeah, Reem, you hit it again on the head. Like, I think a lot of people, they may go from a personality on, like, a social media, and then people are like, you should open a restaurant. But the long hours that's put into running a restaurant, owning a restaurant, and when you're the owner, everything falls on you. So, you know, you have to make sure everyone has everything they need for their stations, pretty much. And then even as a cook, I mean, it's a lot on you, you know, especially if you're like working in high intense restaurants where reviews and accolades are like on the line. So it's very, but one thing I can say about the pandemic, it has like took the people out that really weren't really in the industry.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I mean,
so
kind of people that,
some people that weren't really like, you know, like in between, mm-hmm. like people that are like, hey, you know, like, you know, a lot of kitchen staffs like have been working shorter staff, but these are people that's like, this is my life. You know, I love to cook and this is what I want to do, versus, you know, some people just like, hey, I'm going to go work for Amazon. So that's one thing that the pandemic has done, you know, with a lot of people. But yeah, it's still a tough job.
Is there a favorite time for you in the kitchen, or maybe a least favorite time in the kitchen?
Pre-service,
you know, pre-service.
Like, no, well, like pretty much like a staff meal, you know, everyone's together, you sit down and eat together like a family. And then after that, it's like, then you'll argue as a family, because then it's going to be like, hey, I need this, I need that, you know. So, but then at the end of the night, you guys are backed. You're back.
Yeah. Let me turn to you, Kiki. Is there, I mean, it's interesting thing, and I don't want to talk about Hawaii as if it's a foreign country. It's a part of the United States of America, but obviously has its own unique culture, I guess, because it's an island, for one thing, or several islands, and just the history is so different from the mainland here.
Yes. I often get lumped into conversations about immigration, which I find very odd.
That is odd.
Because my dad was born in Hawaii before Hawaii became a state. Nobody in my family, and my family is composed of many different ethnicities and cultures, nobody immigrated to the U.S.
They all went, were here.
Yeah. Like, America came to us. So I find it, like, really, like, I mean, I can definitely have, I have a lot to say about immigration, like, but not necessarily American immigration. I think a lot of people in Hawaii have similar stories. In Hawaii, we say local to mean imported to the islands, which is a very odd thing to wrap your head around, but once you do, I think things will become clearer. So in Hawaii, much of our population is composed of people who moved to Hawaii to work on its plantations, its sugarcane and later on pineapple plantations, including many of my ancestors. And these people came from all over the world, the Philippines, Portugal, Puerto Rico, Korea, China, Japan, Okinawa, and they all were... they all had to deal with each other, living together on the plantations, and they created what is now to be local food. So in Hawaii, local means the conglomeration of all of these very disparate cultures into one local Hawaii culture. This is different from Hawaiian. Hawaiian is a race, is an ethnicity. Hawaiian is indigenous to Hawaii. Now, there's a lot of overlap, obviously, because like my family's been in Hawaii for five generations. Many of my family members are actually Hawaiian and Pacific Islander. But we have to make this distinction between indigenous and not in Hawaii. It's very important. We have this very, very unique history that's a very, very global history that is not often taught in schools, it seems. I went to school in Hawaii, so I'm not really sure what mainland curriculum is like. Mm-hmm. But ours is a history that's very, very sad, and that's marked by a lot of takeovers and appropriation, and it's something that we live with every single day. And it's really refreshing to go back to Hawaii now and to not have to constantly explain where I'm from, why I eat the things that I do, and why my favorite foods are from all over the world, because in Hawaii they all make sense.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but Reem, let me get to you. And you immigrated to the U.S. as a teenager?
As an undergrad student.
As an undergrad student.
And then I lived out of the U.S. for 5 years in London, and then just recently moved back a few years ago.
And this whole notion, we don't have time to do justice to it, this whole notion of appropriation versus, right. I guess, kind of giving respect to, mm-hmm. I mean, this large world that we all inhabit together.
I think once you start to look at the history of cuisine with a much wider lens and you see how far back it goes, you realize that diffusion is the history of cuisine. It is something that has been happening since the dawn of civilization. You know, like Kiki said, we all learn from each other. We move to different places from other places and our cultures integrate and develop and adapt to what's available in the lands that we inhabit. But I think the important thing, and I'll keep this quick because I know we're at the end, is there's a big difference between culinary diffusion and culinary appropriation. Diffusion is learning from other people. It's adapting recipes to suit your culture, and it's not denying where you learn those things from. Appropriation is when you take something as your own and you don't give credit where it's due. And I think that's what you were talking about when you say respect is even if I want to use your cuisine or take elements of it, at least I should explain and give credit to where I learned those dishes or those techniques or got those ingredients from.
Well, we have to leave it there. Reem Cassis, Kurt Evans, and Kiki Araneta, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. And we do want to close things out with another song. This is Cab Calloway, a song called Everyone Eats When They Come to My House. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste a bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills ya. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Having a derby irby. Look in the fendel mendel. Everybody eats when they come to my house.